Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor at the Mises Institute. And here with me, as usual, is Tho Bishop, my associate editor. And this time, we're going to talk about the issue of the cost that federalism or decentralization seems to impose on some people. And so, Tho, I just want to start us off with a quote. And I think this quote kind of captures the idea here. And I think this will set off the general discussion. And this all relates back to abortion, but it's not just on abortion and what's going on with the Supreme Court right now. I think it goes deeply at the heart of people's issues around decentralization and this urge to not tolerate people doing things differently in other places. So here's the quote. This is from Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. So this is back in 1922, and the case was a case about child labor. And the federal government had attempted to get rid of child labor by imposing special taxes on enterprises where child labor had been used. And Frankfurter had ruled against this. And his reasoning was, he said, "We must pay a price for federalism, even when that price must be the constitutional impotence of the federal government to correct glaring evils unheeded by some of the states." So you have an issue here, right? It's child labor. We all agree that's bad. But Frankfurter's point was is that federalism only means something if you actually have some notion, some respect for the idea that you just can't tell everybody everywhere in the country how to do everything. And this really does impose a cost, the cost that he talks about here. It's a psychological cost in many cases. Just this notion that there are people out there in the world doing things that I find morally objectionable, but which people in that culture find acceptable or in that time, in that place. Shouldn't we do something to stop it? And in the American context, that usually means just abrogating local prerogatives and the ability of local and state polities to adopt their own laws. But in the international market or in the international world, this means things as well, right? There are people in other countries doing things that we find objectionable. And that even bothers a lot of people who think, shouldn't we go in and stop them from doing this? But within these imaginary lines we drew on a map, that we now call the tax farm of the United States, that, boy, I just can't stand the idea that people somewhere else are doing things differently. And that seems to be a major factor, looking at some of the recent op-eds around abortion, that are really pushing this idea that, yes, of course, you need the federal government to control abortion and determine for everybody everywhere in the country what their policies should be.
You're right. And I think it goes to sort of the fetishizing of this sort of political universalism that I think is kind of baked in modern liberalism. Jeff Dice had a good article out today about kind of the new post-liberalism, looking at how you're seeing reactions to this, not only in the U.S., and where I think the Supreme Court ruling is very interesting, where, you know, the Supreme Court as a body has played from a legal foundation towards this centralizing of these sort of cultural norms, you know, ranging not only from the original Roe versus Wade decision, but, you know, you think about, you go into the Obergefell decision and the ruling that had on universal gay marriage within the United States, but also plays with some of the foreign policy conflicts we're seeing, right? You know, the hostility to some of the policies of not only, you know, Vladimir Putin, which is kind of an easy punching bag given the Ukrainian conflict, but Viktor Orban, and some of these other European countries that kind of relish their role as a state leader pushing back against some of these cultural norms that have been adopted by the liberal West and being used to kind of fuel the vision, the angle, the framework of America, or perhaps, you know, within that international sphere, an America led West, Europe, however you want to define that, as being projecting this modern liberal moral ethic in a colonial and modern version of progressive colonialism that can often bump up directly against, you know, these traditional ties of, you know, religious institutions and you know, kind of conservative values, however you want to define that, these other loyalties that different parts, different nations have, whether it is in the American sphere, whether it is the European sphere, international sphere, anything that goes up against sort of Western modernity, and it's been very interesting to see, these fault lines, I think, playing a bigger and bigger role, again, not only in domestic politics, but also in sort of conversations about, international realignment in many ways.
Yeah, the term colonialism, I think, is appropriate in these cases. And to a certain extent, late 19th century, early 20th century, colonialism created the image in many people's minds of like pith helmets and non-white people in other places. But that's in the 18th century, that wasn't the American idea of colonialism. And I think its nature is well captured in Charles Beard's History of America. It's called The History of American Civilization. It's a big fat book now out of print. But you can get it on archive.org and read it there if you want. But he has a chapter in there called The Conflict Between Colony and Metropolis. And you look at it in the American context in the 18th century, and what you got then are people who all consider themselves to be Englishmen. But there's a fundamental conflict between these people in the provinces and then the people back in England, especially around London. They have different cultural and economic interests, and they view people in the colonies as being unsophisticated, rubes, people who don't know what's best for themselves, and people who really should take their cues from London. And that was a major cultural source of the conflict then between the colonies and London. And it had no racial aspect. It was really just a fact that, hey, you people far from the center, you don't understand the way things should be. We people in the sophisticated palaces of London, we know what's best, and we will let you know what is best for you. And of course, they intervened in many ways, denying a lot of rights, sending troops, having kangaroo courts against people who were seen as enemies of the crown and so on, all against Englishmen. And so this was really seen as the colonial relationship at the time. And I think it's in a perfectly appropriate way of viewing the current relationship between many parts of the United States and the metropolis, which is really that New York-Washington axis, of certain types of people who view themselves as really the enlightened few, should really tell the rest of the country how to do things. And I think that is probably at the heart then of this cultural drive to really have federal institutions dictating policy to the rest of the country. And it is a cultural bias. It's a real cultural change. And it doesn't require that you be part of a different civilization or that you be tribesmen and the people in the metropolis be of some sort of different racial makeup. That colonial relationship can exist anywhere. And I think that's really starting to show up then in policymaking in the United States. And you started to see it a little bit, I think, under, or at least it used to be admitted openly, much more so under Obama, when Obama made that crack about how people in the hinterlands cling to their guns and their religion, which his opponents made a lot of hay with. And then you had Hillary, who basically couldn't shed that exact same issue, where she was seen as sort of this haughty person from Washington or from New York, who clearly had no respect whatsoever for people who were outside that axis of cities. And I think the conflict's only just getting worse and worse. And once you have then, I think, a population of people outside the metropoles of sorts who start to see themselves as very different, then they're going to start to push back much more. I think for a long time throughout the 20th century, the elites managed to convince the hayseeds that we all were in this together and we all had interests in common. But I think that sort of thinking is finally starting to break down and people aren't buying it anymore.
Well, and I think it goes to that dynamic of kind of that rule of law, sort of liberalism versus almost a secular faith that leads to a progressive crusade, right? You know, when we talk about, for example, the abortion issue, it's not necessarily, from a federalist perspective, it isn't trying to, use a end of Roe versus Wade to then impose, Alabama abortion laws on the California, right? Yeah, there's that simply breaks down the process by which these laws are made. down at the state level. Now, obviously, there was a great deal that we would say that state and politics should not intervene in terms of you know, cultural and social areas, right? But, you know, the protection of life and property always kind of gets to these very, you know, heated battles between, you know, certain forms of otherwise, you know, libertarian sort of actors, right? You can go back to Mises and Rothbard and some disputes there, you know, but that's a rule of law sort of aspect to this, trying to take away this sense of cultural domination on one side or another, or at least punting that battle of cultural domination down to a state or perhaps, you know, in a better way, a more local area generally. But of course, you know, that is increasingly what the, you know, ruling elite are trying to stamp out entirely, right? This directly goes to the various institutions that have been enacted over the last several decades to trying to rein in national sovereignty. This is why someone like an Orban or a moment like Brexit is viewed as an existential crisis to these, you know, modern liberal institutions of the EU, right? Because, you know, these are people that are bucking you know, these consensus that, you know, we've all agreed that our own national self-interest lead to, you know, very, very terrible things, right? Whether it is war or, you know, the empowerment of these archaic old superstitions, triumphing over reason. And so therefore, you know, if we could simply, you know, disconnect these defenses of, you know, what are seen as, you know, religious, you know, rights of a religious fervor, right? And whether it is, you know, the abortion rights you're seeing, I think, play out now with the transgender issue as that being identified as the important battleground for protecting what is viewed as a victimized class. In this case, you know, the trans or people have gender concerns, right? Trying to liberate them from these, you know, from their parents that are so backwards in their ways and haven't been properly informed on the new way that the American Psychological Association now views, you know, trans issues, right? You know, it creates this crusade. And what is ironic is that it is, you know, another point that Jeff Dice likes to make a great deal is that the people with the power that are imposing their universal morality onto these other groups are always doing so from the framework that they are protecting those being imposed, when instead, no, it's them imposing their worldview on these areas that don't have the same cultural values as big metropolis cities and things like that. And you know, in various ways, this dynamic goes back, you know this is not a modern phenomenon. You can go back, you know, this is a constant conflict here, but, you know, given the new tools of the trade, and also just the transparency allowed with, you know, all the virtues of a digital world, I think that in many ways, I mean, this is very much the battleground beyond any sort of very specific policy issue. This is the dynamic. Where does political legitimacy lie? Does it lie from localism, representation of a community, or is it, the rule of an enlightened elite, whether it be from a scientific process, a proper moral value, you know, whatever those institutions deem as being a necessary goal to civilize society in the right way. I mean, that's I think the foundation of so many of disputes, not only in America but throughout the not just the West, even I think globally at this point.
Well, and what inspired me thinking about this was a series of articles that I started to see from places like the Washington Post and The Nation and so on. And fundamentally, what it came down to was, we can make some legal arguments about what the Constitution says and all that. But fundamentally, keeping abortion legal is a fundamental human right. And if you allow people out in the hinterlands to make their own rules, they're going to do it wrong. And we can't allow that. We have to protect certain human rights. And that's exactly the language used in these articles. One I quote in my article this week on the topic looks at a June 2021 article that says, sure, you can allow some sort of federalism and maybe some decentralization could be tolerated, but you have to guarantee certain minimum fundamental human rights, and you can't compromise on that. And so you cannot allow other governments to have any prerogatives in setting policy around that sort of thing. So what they're saying is this overrides any issues about sovereignty or self-determination because we have declared this to be so important. And you get the exact same language around human rights in the nation, and that this is, I think, what is really going to come down to, because if they lose the legal argument, of course, which essentially you've done, if the Supreme Court declares something to be so, you can, of course, continue arguing that. But then at that point, it's some sort of precedent. You still have to rely on then the moral argument. And this is used all the time to override sovereignty, right? It's used by neoconservatives to say, hey, those people in Iraq, they're doing something bad, and we're going to invade and teach them how to do things. And I found then that the language of human rights is being used by these Washington people is essentially the same as was used in the late 19th century by colonizers. And I found an article here by historian Alice Conklin, where she says that French colonizers, right, they had all these ideas of enlightened republicanism and everything from the revolution. And this is back in the 1890s up until World War I. And she notes that the whole idea here was to liberate Africans from forms of oppression that they believed to exist, including slavery, quote-unquote feudalism, however you want to imagine that, ignorance, and disease. But we're gonna couch it all in liberal terms about how we're limiting our own power over these natives, and we'll create this impression that we're protecting their human rights when we're really just going in and removing all their agency and all their self-determination and taking over their institutions. And that's essentially the exact same logic that we find then from people who think that Washington should boss around the rest of the country on every issue because we're going to teach them human rights and liberate them from their ignorance and their lack of respect for human rights. And there's really no difference here. I think the only real difference is that it's recognized now that we've created really this arbitrary distinction. So someone in Wyoming is within our purview if we can boss them around here in Washington, D.C. So, yeah, they're a couple thousand miles away, but they're in our polity, so we get to tell them whatever we want. However, we have just arbitrarily decided that people in Algeria aren't in France. Now, that is totally an arbitrary distinction because up until the mid-20th century, France considered Algeria to be very much a part of France, complete with representatives in parliament and all of that. And then the only reason they decided Algeria wasn't in France is because the Algerians killed so many French soldiers in the process and managed to win independence. So that decision was forced upon them, but there's no real distinction there. It's just this invented idea. And another article I did recently was called Why the U.S. Supports Secession for Africans, but not for Americans, right? So the question is, gee, why are Africans allowed to secede from another larger polity? So I'm Nigeria. I'm going to secede from Britain because I was essentially indirectly ruled by the British Parliament. I'm going to secede from that. And the U.S. supports that. Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, these people have a right to self-determination. But do you have a right to self-determination if you're in Alaska or you're in some far-flung part of the United States where your culture is very different from the people who are running the government? And there's just this arbitrary idea that no, because just of where your physical location is. And interestingly, some anti-colonial writers addressed this. They addressed the issue of being culturally alien. And so the Westerners are willing to admit that, yeah, Nigeria is culturally alien from London. But that seems more obvious because those people have darker skin and they have different songs and they dress differently in many cases. So we're going to allow them to secede. But what they recognize, and these authors are, if you ever want to look it up, Michael Hecker, Hector and Elizabeth Borland, they have a good article where they say that the cultural alien rule is deemed illegitimate in colonies, but legitimate when it occurs within sovereign states, as in internal colonies. So internal colonies can just be anything like Ireland in relation to England, right, in the 19th century. So we determined those people, they're culturally similar enough that we won't recognize any claims of cultural alien rule In that case, yeah, we'll allow it in case of Africa. But there's no real standard that's ever applied. So now what you've got then is, yep, we can allow people who are within what we define to be the United States, because we've just defined that to be essentially an internal colony that is subject to the Supreme Court. But maybe people in other parts like the Philippines, yeah, we'll let them go. Secession's great in those cases, but not in these other cases we define as just differently. But it's a totally arbitrary definition. And I think that's just really the only thing that stands between this idea of, yep, we're going to tell you people what to think about abortion, and this other idea of, oh, yeah, well, there are four in place, so we won't tell them how to do it.
But of course, there's an aspect to this where you know, to the victor go the spoils, right? And if you look at, you know, the centralization of Europe, if you look at, you know, what allowed Parisian France to, you know, go to war with the Catholic Church within, you know, within the nation of France during the Revolution, it's because they put those outside, you know, those parts of the country outside of city life to the sword. Right. You know, the Reign of Terror was at its bloodiest, you know, outside of Paris. It was in these other parts of France that were remaining loyal to the traditional order, particularly when it came to issues of the church. When you looked at, you know, the spread of Enlightenment ideas, you know, outside of France, within continental Europe, it came at, you know, the march of Napoleon and his artillery. Right. You know, it was a bloody conquest that led these ideas to, again, not only consolidate within the country of France itself, but, you know, led to it going out and you know, which also then had the interesting backlash of European nationalism in many ways as distinguishing a national conscience against sort of Bonaparte rule. Right. And so, you know, there's another element to that, I think, as well, that I think has modern that I think does have some relevance on why the success of this political universalism has played a big role in contemporary history, is that, you know, Napoleon was able to utilize the military benefits of an army mobilized by the sort of you know, nationalist spirit, right? You know, this was the transition away from the army of the king that was often full of you know, questionable characters that were. Yeah, their willingness to fight was always kind of up in the air. They were kind of very much drilled to take on these battles, and you know, where you had instead not only conscription, you know, justified as loyalty to the nation, but also just kind of motivated troops that led to a lot of the speed of Napoleon's military versus other traditional powers and things like that. So there was an element of the revolution that directly corresponded to improvement of the sword of the state that led to superior battles that helped push these ideas out there. In a contemporary context, I think it's less so dealt with military, though obviously there is an aspect where the, you know, national status quo, or that the international global order, that this international rules-based international order, right? You know, which rules vary based on what America wants often. You know, there is a military underpinning there, but I think more powerful than that is corporate international power, which itself is often benefits from, you know, a era of financialization and all the ways that, you know, Mises.org viewers will understand the way central banks and these sort of, you know, multinational institutions can kind of play to helping spread corporate power and subsidizing corporate power. But I think that also kind of lends itself to the goal of cultural homogenization. Because if you have products that if you can reset and normalize the cultural views of a larger and larger international market space, then Disney selling stuff benefits from that, right? And so there's a financial aspect where this liberal colonialism has helped fuel modern armies in the form of corporate and economic power. And so it's not simply that this stuff has happened. And, you know, golly gosh darn, the sides of localism and political decentralization have just lost the battlefield ideas. No, it's that the forces of this form of liberal imperialism have benefited the state and sectors of power in a way to crush those that want to maintain viewpoints that go against whatever the ideology of the governing cities of the day have. And so I think that's when we think about how do we adapt to this particularly populist moment, that's where you're getting to really those core. It's not the intellectual conversation is important, but it also has to go to identifying ways in which we can protect ourselves and isolate ourselves and undermine some of these institutional supports that are fueling this. And that's why it's very interesting, I think, right now, again, seeing a Supreme Court that institutionally has been a major force in the centralization of power, taking one very important cultural step away from that, I think is interesting as an institutional change. And I'm interested to see with other little, again, whether it's Brexit, whether it is, again, you know, nationalist movements in response to the EU, whether it's Bitcoin versus the Fed, right? That is where I think in the contemporary sphere, these genuine institutional challenges to this homogenous power is yeah, that's where the rubber, I think, is really meeting the road. Questioning global public health experts and some of the skepticism about, you know, the World Health Organization treaty and things like that. These are these battles where people are questioning the legitimacy of these centralizing forces. And I think that consistent narrative is far more important than the individual policy battles themselves, not to dismiss, you know, the importance of abortion or tax rates or regulation or anything else that you know, if you've got skin in the game, you care a great deal about.
Yeah, it's a much broader issue. I think we're just seeing it now expressed rhetorically in a full-throated way, I think, from the left, because the abortion issue excites them so much. And so they're just coming out straight out and just saying, this issue's important, so we couldn't care less about issues of local self-determination, localism, et cetera. This is just, all of that's null and void until we need to get our way and have federal policymakers dictate this. Before moving on, I just wanted to go back to your example of the French. I just wanted to note, anyone who's interested in this, check out Charles Tilly's book, The Vendée, from 1964. And this is this just goes to your point, though, where the French state was not going to tolerate any real cultural diversity or any group of people out in the provinces who might go their own way. And Tilly looks at that and really approaches the issue from the issue of culturally alien rule, where the Vendée, and he points out that the places that resisted the French Revolution most were those places that had been least industrialized and where the bourgeoisie had the least amount of influence. And these were more agricultural societies, usually more Catholic as well. Contrary to what some people think, Catholicism had already taken it on the chin big time by the late 18th century. So it wasn't like Paris was this this Catholic commune paradise, and then the revolutionaries did away with that. No, actually, at the center, Catholicism had already been significantly undermined. And what was different was things out in the colonies, that is the provinces far from Paris, where people still lived largely a more late medieval Catholic way of life. And so the French state just sent people out to crush the Vendée, which had attempted some form of counter-revolution in 1793. And Tilly really examines those cultural differences between the places where the revolution was supported and where it wasn't. And it really came down to, how much do these people buy into the idea of bourgeois industrialization and bourgeois ideas of religion? And that was really different. And Paris was not going to tolerate any sort of real self-determination in those areas. And probably for that reason, the French maybe have the most well-developed, and I mean that in a bad way, well-developed notions of centralization and colonial rule, where it was their job to teach people in their colonies what was what, at least where they had the ability. I actually would suggest that in North America, and you were an indigenous population, it was actually to be better under the French than under the British, but I think that was just mostly due to the weakness of the French state in that period. Actually, Lipton Matthews at our site has done some decent work saying that if you were going to be colonized, better to have it done by the British than the French, because the British respected decentralization a little bit more. And so you were more likely, and also they embraced economic liberalism better, so you could at least be economically well off better in British colonies. But in the end, you're still being ruled by some culturally alien force, and the impulse is always the same. Us enlightened people in some far-off metropole, we're going to tell you how to do things. And that's just really the fundamental relationship, I think, that's really being appreciated more and more in the U.S. Now, there's always going to be that strain of thought among people who don't even view national borders as relevant, right? Neoconservatives. So we'll invade whatever country we have to under humanitarian grounds. But the idea of invading foreign countries for humanitarian reasons, again, is the exact same logic as sending federal marshals into Texas or Wyoming or some state that isn't doing things in accordance with the edicts of the federal government. I really don't see a real distinction there other than this arbitrary idea that, hey, we're all Americans. But here's the thing. If people in another part of America are so culturally different from you that you find their way of life abhorrent to the point that you have to send in the federal government to correct that, are you really all Americans? That would suggest that the definition of being an American has to be broadened significantly, or the term doesn't apply to people everywhere in America. So we're getting, I think, to that point where either if America means, yeah, I tolerate people in other parts of the country doing things differently, or you need to make America smaller so as to not include those people who do things in a way you find disgusting.
Right. And of course, there's all sorts of periods of American history where this dynamic of regional differences have played itself. And not only the Civil War itself, which, you know, the issue of slavery being, you know, it's kind of its own right in a variety of ways. And you can get in the, you know, national fugitive slave laws and those dynamics as well, kind of reversing it. But, you know, when we think about, you know, imperialism and reshaping the cultural norms of society, you know, you get to the downsides of that, the consequences of, you know, Reconstruction. And, you know, where, again, like, you know, you have a complete political disenfranchisement of a populace because they are the conquered, right? And it leads to a government completely detached. I mean, we think about legitimacy and things like that. And not that we ever want to give the state too much legitimacy, right? But, like, you know, people that are actively viewing it as their role of using the state to redefine the moral, cultural, historical character of a people, like, that is very different than administering taxes and paving roads, right? And that's a dynamic where it very much is that intersection of the state becoming a cultural crusade of those in power that, you know, you get kind of the worst abuses. And I guess this plays out, you know, throughout history. You know, thankfully we haven't quite, you know, seen, you know, I think since some of the heated battles of states' rights, you know, during the second half of the 20th century, haven't seen quite the explicit depictions of sending in federal troops into states to conquer things. But a part of that is that they've just gotten a lot more clever in the tools used to make states and localities submissive to the national aim, right? This is where funding mechanisms become, you know, play a major role here, you know, whether it is something as relatively minor in the grand scheme of things of using transportation dollars to dictate, you know, road laws in terms of seatbelts and, you know, things like that, or whether it is using grant funding through the education system to push certain, you know, curriculum things to get state education systems to follow whatever national guidance is. You know, it's you know, and they've gotten a lot more creative where it's not simply guns and swords, it is cash and credit. And that makes it harder to see quite often, right? You know, it doesn't have the very vivid depictions, but it can be a just as brutal and far more effective in many ways.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and leave it at that for this episode of Radio Rothbard. We will be back next time, next week, with more. So join us then, and we'll see you next time.